Okay, so good morning. Welcome, everybody. I want to thank, first of all, Ortora for hosting, the Kollel for hosting, and all of you for coming on a beautiful Sunday morning where I'm sure it's tempting to be outside. I know I was tempted to just go for a bike ride. But yeah, it's beautiful out there. So what we're going to talk about today, the topic is Jewish perspectives on genetically modified foods. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Michael Teicher. I was in the Kollel for 2 years. Hard to believe it was now 4 years ago and 3 years ago that I was in the Kollel. Since then, I did a master's in medical sciences at Loyola University, and this past year, I taught AP chemistry and AP biology at Ida Crown. So that's kind of my background, so it's great to be back as part of the Kollel today. So if you're just coming in, there are source sheets and there's a graphic there. Yeah. Extra pen, anyone?
Sure, here.
Okay. So, just by show of hands, I guess, how many people here eat genetically modified foods? Okay, so everyone should be raising their hands, okay? Everyone should have your hand raised, whether you know it or not, whether you like it or not, okay? If you're here, that means you've been eating, and if you've been eating, you're probably eating genetically modified foods. That's the bottom line, whether we like it or not. So what we're going to talk about today is some Jewish perspectives, philosophical, ethical perspectives on the approach to genetically modified foods. And if you take a look at the graphic that I passed out, this kind of summarizes the extent of genetically modified foods in our food supply nowadays worldwide, and kind of where it's most prevalent. So number one is obviously right here in the United States. And the most common in the United States, the most common products containing genetically modified foods are corn or maize, right? Soybean, cotton, canola, sugar beet, alfalfa, papaya, and squash. Okay, so those are the most commonly foods that contain genetically modified foods. And for example, soy, right? So how many people here have mayonnaise in their fridge at home? Okay, so you know the second ingredient in mayonnaise is soybean oil. Okay, and not only is soy a commonly genetically modified food, but to give you an extent of how much of the soy that's out there is genetically modified, somewhere between 80 and 90% of all soy worldwide is genetically modified. Okay, so there is no avoiding it. My son, who's now almost 2 years old, he has some allergies, and we initially suspected that he was allergic to soy. So we were told to take soy out of the diet. And that's how we discovered that really soy is in everything. Thank God he's not allergic to soy, but the bread you buy at Jewel, right, has soy in it. Right, everything has soy. Right, corn, right, is a very common one. Something like 35 to 40% of all corn is genetically modified. So things that contain corn syrup, right, which is everything, right, and obviously corn itself. Okay, lots of ingredients that go into making the foods we take for granted and eat every day contain ingredients that come from genetically modified crops. And if you take a look kind of like just by the color coding on the map, you notice that most prevalently United States and Canada are like kind of like in the top. Latin America as well. Europe is a little bit of a different situation. Europe has taken a little bit of a different approach, and they're much more restrictive and much more regulatory when it comes to genetically modified crops, and we could talk about that a little bit as well. But certainly Southeast Asia, it's prevalent as well, Australia. So it's really worldwide. And in terms of the prevalence worldwide, so you have soybean, cotton, maize, and canola are the top four genetically modified crops. Cotton as well, right? Cotton, about 80% of cotton is genetically modified worldwide. 80%. And you think, well, cotton's not a food, right? Except when you look in lots of ingredients, you'll see cottonseed oil, right? Cottonseed oil. Right, for Pesach. So cottonseed oil also often comes from genetically modified cotton, okay? So some of the issues that we're going to talk about are kind of like the ethical implications of all of this from a Jewish perspective. And if you take a look on the source sheet now, if you open the cover, you see I have here, this is a photocopy of the cover of Time magazine from July 2000. Okay, the man on the cover here is Dr. Ingo Potricus, who is famous for being one of the co-inventors of golden rice. Okay, how many people here have heard of golden rice? Okay, so it hasn't been in the news in quite a while, right? But in the year 2000, when it came out, it was very big news, right? The cover of Time magazine. So the story with golden rice very quickly is as follows. So about a third of the world population subsists on a diet that consists mostly of just rice, okay? Especially in places like Southeast Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, Right? And there's tremendous problems with nutritional deficiencies in these places, namely vitamin A deficiency. Okay? Because rice, the way that humans like it for consumption, basically, is that rice is polished, and in doing so, we remove a lot of the nutritional value of the rice. That's why when you order brown rice, it looks a little different. It's because it hasn't been polished. Okay? So brown rice actually has more nutritional value. Right? So these cultures that subsist mostly on rice have problems with nutritional deficiency, vitamin A deficiency, which leads to things like blindness, severe nutritional problems in children especially. And Dr. Potrikas and his colleagues found a way to actually engineer the rice to contain more beta-carotene. Okay, now beta-carotene is a precursor in your body for the production of vitamin A. Okay, your body is able to take beta-carotene and produce vitamin A from the beta-carotene. So we basically now are engineering rice to contain more nutritional value, right, to contain beta-carotene, and it was called golden rice because of its yellow color, right, because of the beta-carotene that was contained in it. And this was kind of like advertised and publicized as a way to really achieve food security, especially in the developing world, to combat vitamin A deficiency, and as you see, the cover of Time magazine proclaimed, this rice could save 1 million kids a year, right? So it was extremely promising, right? Really extremely promising, and Dr. Potrikas and his colleagues actually wanted to give the rice away to subsistence farmers, right? For any farmers that were making less than $10,000 a year, it would be completely free, no royalties, no patent problems, et cetera, et cetera. The problem was, if you had followed the story of golden rice at all, the problem was that Dr. Potrikas and his colleagues themselves ran into many issues with patents, that many of the techniques that they used had already been patented by other countries. So they actually had problems with about 70 patent copyright infringements that they had to then go through all the red tape to get each company, right, that had patented each technique to agree to license it for free to these farmers. So it was a bureaucratic nightmare, right? And once corporations got involved, right, corporate greed took over somewhat. There were lots of protests throughout the world in terms of people calling this Frankenfood, people calling this, you know, it was unnatural, genetically altered. And it never really came to market, never really achieved its full potential. As far as I know, they're still trying to bring it to market for these subsistence farmers. And it's still an ongoing effort, but it's really faced fierce opposition from the perspective both of copyright law and from the perspective of it being unnatural, of, let's say, there's a fear, for example, of corporations, right, getting entire countries hooked on their product, so to speak, right? And if it's patentable, right, and if you own the rights to the staple of the diet of, let's say, Indonesia, right, so you can imagine the kind of power that wields, right? So that's part of the controversy as well. So let's take a look at page number one on the source sheet. So I want to start with a couple of quotes here that really, I think, summarize a couple of issues in the debate over genetically modified foods. So before we do that, first of all, any questions until now? Okay. So what we're going to do now is we're going to talk about what the issues are that are... Yeah?
Oh, it's not so much a question. We can call it corporate greed, but it's not so much greed, but they put a lot, as with any medicine, they
yeah.
put a lot of
right.
Money into developing these seeds in,
right.
In the soil, and then, there's another thing about the pesticides.
Yeah.
And they have to recoup their investment.
Yeah. No, correct. Yeah, correct. We're not going to go into a whole discussion over right copyright law and the propriety of patents in this area, but that's certainly one of the contested areas, right? There's two sides to that coin, right? The corporations correctly say that we do invest a lot of money in developing these technologies and developing the products, and we need to recoup our investment.
And the universities like Illinois and Champaign one of the
Yeah. So we need to recoup our investment, and that's certainly valid. The flip side of that also is that, people feel that you're patenting something which used to be just natural and free, right? Every year, for thousands and thousands of years, a farmer would plant his or her crops, right, and save some of the produce for the next year to plant. But with a lot of these genetically modified foods, because of licensing issues, you can't save the seeds from year to year. You have to buy them every year from the company. Okay? So that's part of the issue as well. So we're going to kind of like frame our issue a little bit, and then I'm going to give a very brief, 5-minute introduction to a little bit of the science behind it as to what exactly are the techniques we're using to genetically modify the foods, and we'll go straight into the Jewish perspective. So the first source over here, making the yellow soil express its summer thought in bean leaves and blossoms rather than in wormwood and piper and millet grass. Making the earth say beans instead of grass, this was my daily work. Henry David Thoreau in Walden. And this quote is actually the opening of a book called Mendel in the Kitchen. Okay, it is not, as one of my friends suggested, a Chabad cookbook, but it's actually a book written by a scientist named Nina Fedorov, who is one of the leaders in agricultural biotechnology. And she opens her book with this quote from Thoreau, basically to express the idea, well, humans have been modifying the earth and modifying nature and agriculture for our purposes since time immemorial, right? The technique is new, the idea is not, right? We've been domesticating crops for thousands of years, we've been selecting traits, desirable traits, and therefore desirable genes for thousands of years, right? It's somewhat unnatural to plant a field that grows beans instead of grass, right? If you leave nature to its own devices, it'll just grow weeds and grass. But we change nature in order for the purpose of human benefit. So that kind of like sums up Professor Fedorov's argument. If you look at the next quote, it is because of our inability or refusal to accept the existence of a guiding hand that nature has come to be regarded as a system that can be engineered for our own convenience or as a nuisance to be evaded and manipulated. We need to rediscover a reverence for the natural world, irrespective of its usefulness to ourselves, to become more aware of the relationship between God, man, and creation. Charles, Prince of Wales. So Prince Charles is a very outspoken opponent of genetically modified foods, genetically modified crops, and he gave what's actually a fascinating lecture. You can find this lecture online, the text of it. And it's actually a very well-developed and very thoughtful lecture. And what he says here, what he argues is, listen, you know, we're kind of playing God in this area, right? Yes, it may provide some benefit to humans, right? But we need to reclaim that reverence for nature. What about reverence for the natural world, respect for the natural order, for the natural law, right? That sense that, well, this is unnatural, okay? And that's the crux of his argument. And that's part of that flip side of the debate in genetically modified foods. So a lot of people feel this way, right? Certainly from a Jewish perspective, this is an important question for us to ask, right? Us who believe in a God who is the creator of the universe and the lawgiver not only of divine law but of natural law, well, don't we have to respect that natural law, right? If God created things to function a certain way, what business do we have changing nature, right? That's the question. And the next quote here kind of summarizes what we talked about on the graphic in terms of the extent of genetically modified foods and the data, the graphic as well. It's from an organization called the International Service for the Acquisition of Agrobiotech Applications, which is based in Cornell University. So, just very briefly, what are we talking about when we're talking about genetically modifying foods? For what purposes do scientists want to genetically modify foods? So anyone know? Yeah?
Well, you just made one point that you can infuse in with more...
So nutrition, nutritional value. Right.
But also to resist bugs or erratic weather or adapt to different climates.
And those things are much more common than adding nutritional value. Golden rice was kind of like the first product that actually was successful in increasing and modifying the nutritional value of a food. Most applications of genetically modified crops seek to, exactly what you said, right, to make a crop more pest resistant, for example, or pesticide resistant. So the famous example is the Roundup Ready soybeans. Anyone heard of Roundup Ready soybeans? So this is a product that's developed by the Monsanto company. And Monsanto makes a pesticide, and they also make soybeans that are resistant to that pesticide. So you have to buy both, right? So and the advantage to the farmer is obvious, right? You can therefore just spray the pesticide, kill everything else except for your crop of interest, except for the soybeans. So that's a very prominent application, right? Tons of soybeans, right? We said 80 to 90% are genetically modified. So a lot of that is this Roundup Ready soybeans, okay? Pesticide resistance. Yeah? Roundup is an herbicide, right? It's an herbicide technically. Yeah, the pest in this case is other plants.
Everything except for the mm-hmm. special.
Yes. Mm-hmm. There are other techniques that seek to make a plant resistant to viruses, seek to make a plant resistant to other diseases, or weather resistant, frost resistance. Okay, they're talking about taking a gene from a certain Arctic fish, that produces its own antifreeze, so to speak, and putting it in plants to enable those plants to grow in colder climates. Okay? So very interesting application. Increasing yield is another big one. Okay? So getting more productive crops on smaller acreage, right? And the issue here, the advantage here, is obvious, right? As the world population expands and arable land is in very short supply, so from an environmentalist perspective, many people say, well, this is better for the environment because we're able to now get more bang for our buck, so to speak, right? We're able to get more product, more produce from a smaller area of land. So it's more efficient. So that's part of it. Okay, so that's the idea. Now, how exactly do they introduce the genes? We're not going to get too much into the technicalities of the science, but there are basically two methods. One is called using a gene gun, where they literally take DNA and they coat it on these small metal pellets, very often gold. And they literally just will shoot the DNA into a cell, into a plant cell, to force the plant to incorporate that DNA. And the DNA, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. The DNA can sometimes incorporate itself into the plant's genome. Another very prominent method of inserting foreign genes into the genes of a plant is via using a certain bacterium called Agrobacterium tumefaciens. So this is a bacteria that naturally causes what's called crown gall disease, which is a plant tumor. And the way this bacterium works, it's very interesting. It attacks its host. It attacks the plant by attaching to it physically, inserting part of its genes into the plant. Those genes then incorporate itself into the plant genome, and then those proteins get produced along with everything else in the plant, and those proteins cause a tumor. Okay, so this bacteria has found a way to incorporate itself into plant genes. What scientists have been able to do is remove the tumor part of the gene. Right? Remove the tumor part and insert higher yield gene. Right? Insert pest resistance. Right? Insert whatever you want. Okay, so they're able to capitalize on a natural process to deliver genetic material. Okay, so fascinating stuff. So that's the basic idea. Now to the Jewish perspective. Okay? Any questions? Yes?
I have a question. I went to Trader Joe's, and they have products, soybean oil, canola oil, and I said, yeah, this is genetically modified. Oh, we don't carry anything. So we do assume that all canola, all, or do they have things that maybe aren't?
No, it's not all. It's like 80-90% worldwide. So it could very well be that Trader Joe's makes sure to get, you know, soybeans that are not grown from genetically modified seeds. I mean, that's...
Do I ask them about this?
Well, if it's labeled organic, there are laws that regulate an organic label. Let's say you're not allowed to put the label that says like USDA organic. You're not allowed to put that label on a crop that's been genetically modified by law. Now, you know, are they breaking the law? Hopefully not, right? So... Right. I don't know. Right, I don't know. I mean, it's certainly possible that Trader Joe's gets from, you know, that 10% that are not genetically modified. That's certainly possible, okay? So, where I want to start, and I guess our point of departure is going to be from Bereshit Perek Aleph, the story of creation, right? Taking a look at the natural order and trying to figure out our place within it. So, if you take a look at source number one, Vayomer Elohim, Tadshe ha'aretz desha, esef mazriya zera, et pri osef pri limino, asher zerabo ala aretz vayihi chen. So when God created the world, the Torah tells us something very interesting and important with regard to this topic about how God created nature. He created everything to be limino, right? According to its species. And if you take a look at the next pasuk, nature dutifully complied with God's demand, right? Vatotseha aretz deshe, and the land put forth grass. Esav mazriya zera liminehu, v'etz ose pri asher zarabo liminehu, vayara Elohim kitov. Right? Everything was commanded and everything was set at the point of creation to reproduce liminehu, right? According to its own species, right? Species A always produces species A, okay? Faithful reproduction. That's part of the natural law. Certainly that's laid out in Sefer Bereshit. And then God makes the pronouncement as well, Vayara Elohim Kitov, right? God saw that it was good. He approved of this process of liminehu, of things faithfully giving rise to its own kind. And then if you take a look at the creation of man in Pasuk Chavav, Vayomer Elohim, Na'ase Adam b'tzalmenu kidmutenu, v'yirdu v'dgat hayam v'of ha'shamayim v'v'behema v'v'chol ha'aretz v'chol ha'remes ha'rames al ha'aretz. On the other hand, when God created man, he created man presumably for the purpose of v'yirdu. What does v'yirdu mean?
To rule over.
To have dominion over. Right? There is a double meaning of this word v'yirdu. V'yirdu is the same word as another word that might be familiar to us.
Arrayed Adam.
Right, laredet, right? You're ready, like, to go down. And actually, there's a medrash over here in this pasuk that says, makes exactly this point, that man has an opportunity to either rule or to fall, right? There's that double-edged sword, that if we actualize our potential, then we become rulers. If we don't actualize our potential, then we fall to great depths. So it's this play on words. So that's the context in which man was created. Presumably, on the one hand, there is a natural law. On the other hand, we're charged with being rulers over nature, with rulers over the animals and the plants. So the next section I call the natural, the unnatural, and the supernatural. Okay? So this is, we're really here going to talk about the issue of whether this is unnatural. Are we subverting God's will by changing nature, by genetically engineering species that wouldn't exist naturally? So the context in which this comes up is fascinating. It's the context of the mitzvah of kilayim. Okay? So anyone want to volunteer kind of like a brief explanation of what kilayim is?
That's crossbreeding.
Right. Right, crossbreeding different species, right? Exactly. And in Parshat Kedoshim in Vayikra Yud Tet, Pasuk Yud Tet, in source number 2, Et chukotai tishmoru, behemtecha lo tarbiya kilayim, sadecha lo tizra kilayim, uveged kilayim shatnez lo ya'ale alecha. There are three types of kilayim that the Torah lays out for us in this Pasuk. A fourth one is mentioned later in Sefer Devarim in Parshat Re'eh. The three types here are kilayim, crossbreeding of animals, right? Sadecha lo tizra kilayim, of plants, right, which is relevant to us. And clothing, the case of shatnez, of wearing a garment that has wool and linen together. Okay, the fourth one mentioned in Parshat Re'eh is a special case of plants. That's the case of kilay hakerem, of a vineyard. Grapes have their own special halachot of kilayim. So the question now is, well, why did the Torah legislate this mitzvah? Right? The Torah prohibits us from crossbreeding different species, right? Certainly this is relevant for us to look at in our case. We're doing something that may not be quite crossbreeding, but it's very similar. So the Ramban here, in source number 3, so the Ramban, you have a kind of brief biography here, of Moshe ben Nachman. Okay, so he lived in Gerona, Spain, in Barcelona as well. And the Ramban offers what he thinks is the Tam HaMitzvah, the reason for the mitzvah. Okay? And it's interesting that he starts by quoting Rashi. Rashi here, in the first line in the Ramban, he's quoting Rashi. He says, Chukim elu gzerot melech she'in tam ledavar, Lashon Rashi. Rashi picks up on the fact that the pasuk here describes this mitzvah as a chok, et chukotai tishmoru. Now, what's the difference between a chok and a mishpat? Right, a chok presumably is a mitzvah for which we don't know the reason or for which there is no reason. Okay? And Rashi says here, regarding these mitzvot, she'in tam ledavar. There's no reason for these things. So Rashi would seem to kind of like end our discussion right now. Right? If this really is a chok, we can't necessarily extrapolate the instance of kilayim to the case of genetic engineering. Right? It would presumably only be limited. But the Ramban thinks that's not the case. The Ramban says, Ve'ena kavana behem shetihye gzirot melech machem lachim b'shum makom b'lo tam. Right? Even a chok, says the Ramban, and this is true of his opinion in general, the Ramban thinks that even things that are chukim, even take para aduma, right? There's still some reason that's waiting to be discovered. Some may be easier to discover than others. There's some reason that's there to teach us something. God doesn't just willy-nilly legislate mitzvot for absolutely no purpose whatsoever. He thinks that's inconceivable. And then he goes on to offer a reason for kilayim, which is very interesting and relevant to our topic. He says, V'hatam b'kilayim, or in the second paragraph in Source 3, Ki Hashem bara haminim ba'olam b'chol ba'alei nefeshot b'tzmachim uva'alei nefesh ha'tenua. God created all of the creatures and all of the, you know, the species of this world, v'natan behem koach atolada, and he gave to each of them, right, the power to reproduce. Koach atolada, the power of reproduction. Sheit kaimu haminim behem la'ad kol zman sheyirtze hu yitbarach b'kiyum ha'olam, that they should propagate their species as long as the world continues to be in existence. And he commanded each species that they should faithfully reproduce their own species. It says, Leminehu. And then he goes on to say, where it's bold, V'hamarkiv shnei minin, and one who crossbreeds two species, Meshane umakhish b'maseh v'reshit. You're changing and denying, rejecting maseh v'reshit, rejecting creation. It's like you're thinking that God didn't create the world with all that was necessary. You say, well, you know what? I'm going to improve on God's work. I'm going to add more creations to the world. And the Ramban says there's a second problem as well. God created everything with what he called the koach ha-tolada, the power to reproduce. And very often, in crossbreeding, we're taking away that koach ha-tolada. I take the classic example is a mule, right? Crossbreed a horse and a donkey, and you get a mule. So it's a viable animal, but the mule is sterile, right? And this is not always true in nature, and it's not always true in plants, but very often it is. It's interesting, specifically in the case of the way genetically modified foods are made nowadays, that the companies like Monsanto and DuPont and all these companies that are really big in the genetically modified foods, they specifically make seeds that cannot be planted year after year. They take away their koach ha-tolada specifically, right? So that the farmers will have to buy them year after year from the company. Okay, so that's interesting as well. So the Ramban says there are two reasons. You're taking away the koach ha-tolada, and it's as if you know better. You're saying to God, you created the world a certain way, but you know what? It wasn't good enough. Right? So says the Ramban. And then the second bold sentence here, he says, "V'hine mitzad shnei ha-dvarim ha'ela," because of these two reasons, "pu'ulat ha-harkava b'minim davar nim'as u'batel." Therefore, this thing is considered to be an abhorrent practice, and it's outlawed by the Torah. So says the Ramban.
Right, but we don't believe that, because then we wouldn't allow IVF. So we wouldn't follow this.
What do you mean?
It's the same thing. Because we would say we couldn't help a couple get pregnant.
Right.
Because if they can't do it on their own, they can't do it on their
own. Yeah, so right. So you're bringing up an interesting connection to medicine here. Right? It's an interesting connection to medicine. We're running into a very similar problem that does exist in medicine in terms of Jewish thought and the role of a doctor in medicine, right? The Gemara says, the Gemara in Brachot says, the Gemara quotes the Pasuk, V'rapo yirapeh, right? That the Pasuk in Parshat Mishpatim, that from here we learn that a doctor has the license to heal. And then that kind of like begs the question, well, why is there a license necessary, right? Why does the Torah need to give permission? Would we think it was prohibited? So Rashi there in the Gemara in Brachot says, yes, for this very reason. Rashi says, because really, it's as if you're saying, you know, who made this person sick to begin with? Ultimately, God. Right? You're saying to God, you know, you made this person sick, but I'm going to go against your will. I'm going to subvert the divine will. Right? That's what you would think, but therefore the Torah says specifically, no, we are given license, not only license, it's a mitzvah to heal someone who's sick, even though, in some sense, we are subverting the divine will. Right? So then the question arises, well, that's a specific to medicine, virapo yirape, and healing somebody. Does that apply to also, say, genetically modifying nature that isn't necessarily for medicinal purposes, right? For healing someone who's sick, right? That's the question.
Starvation.
Right. So I was about to say, the flip side of the coin is that, right, hunger is an illness and the cure is food, right? So that's another part of it. However, right, and that's certainly a strong argument when it comes to things like golden rice and increasing yield in third world countries and things like that. But many of the genetically modified crops nowadays have no benefit to the consumer whatsoever. The benefit is to the farmer and to the company, right? It's able to be more profitable. A good example is the first ever genetically modified food to come to market in 1994. It was called the Flavor Saver Tomato. Right? Flavor Saver Tomato. It was on the market for only 3 years before the company became no longer profitable. And the Flavor Saver Tomato was presumably solving the problem for tomato farmers in the fact that if you pick a tomato when it's ripe and when it tastes best, by the time it gets to Jewel, it's going to be rotten, right? And if you pick it before it's ripe to give it time to ripen, well, it doesn't really ripen with all the, you know, to all its natural flavor, and it's going to get to Jewel green, like the tomatoes you do see in Jewel, right? So what they still do, believe it or not, is they pick them when they're green, they pick them before they're ripe, and then they actually spray them with ethylene gas to artificially turn them red, to make them look better, even though they still taste like not ripe. We've all had tomatoes. So, right, so that's what they do. So the Flavor Saver tomato was genetically modified to essentially slow the rotting process in the tomato. So you can pick them when they're ripe, and they'll have longer shelf life, and they'll be able to get to market while they're still red and just as tasty. That was the idea. So there's no real, you know, can you say there's a medicinal benefit there trying to, you know, cure starvation? No. It's better, right? It's better business, right? It's a more marketable product, right? The consumer likes to get a redder tomato. But it's hard to argue there that it's really under the context of Virapo Yurapé. So certainly Virapo Yurapé would cover a lot of this, but there's a good portion of it that it really doesn't. Okay? But that's an excellent point. So so says the Ramban. Let's take a look at source number 4. The Sefer HaChinuch was written by, well, it's a good question. We don't really know for sure who it was written by. Many people think it was someone by the name of the Ra'a, Rav Aaron Halevi, who was one of the prominent students of the Ramban, of this same Ramban who we just saw. Okay? Presumably it was written by one of the students of the Ramban, but the authorship is somewhat in question. So the Sefer HaChinuch lists all the 613 mitzvot according to the Parsha. So it's great Shabbos table learning. And he offers his idea for what he calls the Shorash HaMitzvah, the root of the mitzvah of Kilayim. And he says in a very similar vein to the Ramban, first he quotes the Pasuk V'hine Tov Ma'od, where it's bold there, the first bold. And that God, when he created the world, he pronounced it was Tov Ma'od. So who are we to come and say, you know what, but it wasn't good enough. Right? God already said it was Tov Ma'od. And the Chinuch says in the second paragraph, Uvihiyot yodeh Elokim ki kol asher asahu mechuvan b'shlemut l'inyano shuhu tzarich b'olamo. Since God knows, God is all-knowing, and He knows that each species fills its niche perfectly in the world. Tziva l'cho min v'min l'hiyot oseh perotav l'minehu. Again, he quotes l'minehu. Kimo shekatuv b'seder bereshit. V'lo yit'arvu haminin, and we're not allowed to mix species. And here the Chinuch adds something. Pen yechaser shlemutan. Because maybe there's going to be some detrimental effect, says the Chinuch. V'lo yitzaveh aleihen birchato. And therefore, it wouldn't be covered under God's bracha, so to speak, to fulfill its role in the context of nature, in its ecological context. Because maybe we're going to cause more harm than good. And the Chinuch says, and I've alluded to a similar reason, and I've elaborated on this previously somewhere else. The question is, where is that somewhere else? So if you look on source number 5, on page 3, look at source number 5. The Chinuch writes about this in a place that's a little less obvious to look than Kilayim. Right, we talked about Kilayim, but the Chinuch writes about this in the context of the mitzvah of Kishuf. Anyone know what the mitzvah of Kishuf is?
Witchcraft,
essentially. Black magic, right? And this is not a shiur on black magic and witchcraft, but the Chinuch, in the context of writing about the reason for the mitzvah of Kishuf, he says the idea behind why Kishuf is prohibited, why black magic is prohibited, because it's an effort to subvert natural law. So says the Sefer HaChinuch. He quotes that same Laminehu here, right? That nature has been appointed, so to speak, to work in certain ways, according to certain laws, according to certain processes, and we're trying to subvert that process. And the Chinuch says, in the underlined section here, he says something else. He said, "Mipnei zeh mina amehem." What's that zeh? Sorry, the previous sentence before the underline starts. Ki, in the middle of the line. Ki yodea Elokim shesof hama'aseh hayotzeh livnei adam ba'otan tzadin ra lehen. Mipnei zeh mina am mehen. Because God knows that by tampering with nature, we're harming ourselves. We're harming our own environment, and we're causing detrimental effects. V'zehu amram zichronam levracha derech kla kol sheyesh bo mishum rufua in bo mishum darkei emori. Then he quotes a Gemara in Shabbos, which is a fascinating source in this context. He mentions what he alludes to, the topic, as you mentioned before, of refua, of medicine. And Chazal make a statement that anything that seems to be prohibited because of black magic, or it seems to be subverting nature, is prohibited except if it has a medicinal purpose. Kol davar sheyesh bo mishum refua, ein bo mishum darkei ha'emori. Anything that is considered medicinal does not fall under the purview of darkei emori, of superstition, of black magic, of kishuv. And he says, "Klomar ein lo osro mipnei tzad kishuv achar sheyesh toelet bo matzui b'nisayon be'emet ein ze min hatzadin ha'asurin ki lo ne'asru rak mitzad ha'nezek shebehen." And then the Chinuch elaborates, and he says, "Nothing is prohibited if it has been what he calls yesh toelet bo matzui b'nisayon be'emet. It has a purpose that's been tested, a true purpose that's been tested for the purpose of causing benefit to man." So says the Sefer HaChinuch. Anything that benefits man, anything that has shown to be beneficial, by definition does not fall into the category of kishuv, because kishuv is prohibited only because we're changing nature with detrimental effects. We're changing nature for the worse. So says the Sefer HaChinuch. And he says, and that's true not only by kishuv, it's true by kilayim as well. So interesting. So the Chinuch, who elaborates on the Ramban's opinion, he has this caveat, right? And he seems, not only does he have the caveat, but he seems to expand what we call medicine, right? So take the Flavor Saver tomato, for example. According to the Chinuch, you might be able to now argue, well, it does have a to'elet shematsui b'nisayon be'emet. It does have a purpose that's been tested, and that's an improvement for the human condition, right? Even if it's not purely medicinal, right?
Wouldn't this also seem to argue that you can't be involved in the experimentation of, but once benefit has been proven, you can sort of use what's there to further that?
Yeah,
because one, it has to be proven to be beneficial. So if I'm in the process of trying to prove that, I don't know what I'm doing. And it could be detrimental, it could be that. So until you've had a process that's been proven to be beneficial, you might not be able to get...
Yeah, that's interesting, right? Because you're always, right, a scientist is always faced with that problem, right? You can't prove something until you prove it. So yeah, that's interesting. You know, so it reminds me of the Meiri, who is another one of the Rishonim. So he comments also on this same topic of Kishuv, and in Sanhedrin, and he says as follows. He says, anything that can be, that has a natural explanation, that can be explained essentially by science, that has a logic to it, is by definition not under the purview of Kishuv. And the Rambam, Maimonides, says something very similar. He says, Kishuv, part of the way you can identify that something is Kishuv is that it has no logical or natural explanation. It's hocus pocus. Okay, and this is not agreed upon by all Rishonim, but this is the Rambam's approach. The Meiri takes the same approach. And the Meiri comments, fascinatingly, he says, even if we were able one day to, you know, create new human beings without fertilization, says the Meiri in the 12th century, right? Which we can do nowadays, right? He says, that's not Kishuv if it's based on reasoning and a natural process and a scientific theory, right? So according to the Rambam and the Meiri, then it kind of like expand that license, because scientists don't dive in, even before something is proven, they don't dive into an experiment without a hypothesis, right? A scientific hypothesis. But that's a good question. So we're going to kind of wrap up the last part here. Just kind of like to summarize what we've said so far. So we've seen kind of like the Ramban and the Chinuch as well really kind of restricting our urge, so to speak, right? To kind of like delve in and intervene with nature, right? At least without pause, right? According to the Ramban, it seems to be kind of like a blanket prohibition. According to the Chinuch, according to the Sefer HaChinuch, it's a prohibition that stands, but you have to consider, does it have benefit to man? Does it have benefit that can be tested, that can be explained? Does it have benefit that is tangible, right? That's what the Chinuch seems to define it. So if you look in section 3 here, so the quote I have here, the Creator has made creation creative. So this is a quote from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who just retired as the chief rabbi of the United Kingdom. So this, you know, he has such a way with words, and I think it summarizes it very nicely in terms of he's describing, when he said this, he was describing his outlook on man's role vis-a-vis nature. He said, the Creator, God, has made creation, us, creative in turn, right? That we are also creators in some sense. So how does that bear out in the sources? If you take a look at source number 6, so we have the mitzvah of v'kiv shuha, right? God created us and told us, "Peruvu meluta aretz v'kiv shuha," and conquer it, subdue the earth. And then, and in the next pasuk, in pasuk chaf tet, "Vayomer Elohim, hinei natati lachem et kol esav zorea zera asher al pnei kol aretz, et kol ha'etz asher bo pri etz zorea zera lachem yehe le'ochla." Right? I've given you everything, to all the plants and all the animals, to eat and to use for your purpose. And the Ramban in source 7, the very same Ramban who we saw before, says as follows: V'kiv shuha natan lahem koach u'memshala ba'aretz la'asot kirtzanam ba'behemot u'v'shratzim v'chol zochalei afar v'livnot v'la'akor lintoa u'mahararea lachtzov nechoshet u'chiyotze bazeh. That same Ramban says the mitzvah of kiv shuha tells man to be creative, to modify the earth as we see fit, right? To mine, to plant, to uproot, to build, to change nature, right? So part of the argument with genetic engineering, and what many scientists will say, is that it's just another way of modifying nature in ways that we've been doing for thousands of years, right? Everything we do is, unless you know you're out living in the wilderness, right, living in the jungle, and as a hunter-gatherer, right, you're modifying nature, right? Human civilization rests on the ability to modify nature. And it's that very same Ramban that says there's a mitzvah here of v'kiv shuha. Let's take a look at source number 9. So kind of like, how do we kind of you know, reconcile these two opposing approaches, even within the Ramban. Right? On the one hand, we have to respect God's creation and respect our boundaries. And on the other hand, we are creators, and we have a mitzvah of a kivshua. So source number 9 is such a fascinating source regarding this topic. Source number 9 says as follows. Gemara in Pesachim, Rabbi Yossi Omer, Shnei Dvarim Alu B'machshava Libarot Be'erev Shabbos V'lo Nivru'u Ad Motzei Shabbos. There were two things that God intended to create on Erev Shabbos and the 6 days of creation, but were not created until Motzei Shabbos. Over Motzei Shabbos, Natana Kadosh Baruch Hu Deya Ba'adam Harishon Me'in Dugma Shamala. And on Motzei Shabbos, God gave man an essence of the divine mind, so to speak. And he took together, man took together two rocks, struck them together, and made fire. And he put two animals together and made a mule. Right? So, kilayim. Strange. So this Gemara here seems to really, it's a very, in a very positive light. Natan, he did this with a me'in dugma shamala, with an essence of the divine mind. That man was seen as creating something new, creating fire and creating a species that didn't yet exist. And the Maharsha has a fascinating explanation on this Gemara. He says, in source 10, Shnei Dvarim, etc. Hein ba'atzman shnei hadvarim sh'amar Rabbi Nechemya le'el, af ha'ur ve'ha'pered shegam heim alu b'machshava ve'erev Shabbos, Dahainu, shenivra'u b'koach, Dahainu ha'ur b'koach shtei avanim, v'haperet b'koach shtei behemot. Aval lo yatzu lefol ela ad motzei Shabbos al yedei dat ufu'ulat adam. The Maharsha says as follows. What God created, when it says that God had intended to create these things on Erev Shabbos, what he did was he put the potential there in nature. And what man did was simply extract that potential. Right? And I think this really summarizes, just on a very personal level, like, kind of like my view and how I look at it. You know, people ask kind of like, are we playing God and are we changing nature? What the Maharsha, I think, is saying is that that question itself contains a little bit of hubris. Right? That question assumes that we're changing nature. We're not changing nature. Man has no ability, scientists have no ability to change the laws of nature. Right? What we're doing is taking something that's already there, the potential that's already there, and bringing it into reality. Right? For example, right, Einstein didn't invent relativity. Right? He described it. He discovered it. Right? That's what scientists do. Right? Scientists don't invent new science. The science was already there. It's just waiting to be discovered and used. Right? And that's what the Maharsha says. That's what he says occurred with the creation of fire and with the creation of the donkey, according to this Gemara in Masechet Pesachim. And so just to finish off, to summarize what this will end, if you take a look at source number 13, there's a pasuk in Kohelet. Re'e et ma'aseh ha'elokim ki mi yuchal letaken et asher ivto. Consider the work of God, for who can make straight that which he had made crooked. It's interesting, this is not really for this year, but it's a question as to who the he is in this sentence, who the subject is in this sentence. The translation writes it with a capital H, implying that it's God. But what the Medrash does here, in Kohelet Rabbah, in source 14, says something different. Re'et ma'aseh ha'elokim ki mi yuchal letaken et asher ivto, b'sha'a shebara ha'kadosh baruch hu et adam harishon, nitalo v'achziro al kol ilanei gan eden v'amar lo, re'e ma'aseh, kama na'im u'mushubachin hein. When God created man, he took him around gan eden, he gave him a tour, he said, look at all my creations, look how beautiful they are. Right? Look how wonderful everything is. Kol ma shebarati bishvil chabarati. Everything that I created is for you, for your benefit. Ten de'atcha. Take care. Shelo tekalkel v'tachriv et olami. Don't mess it up. She'im kilkalta, ein mi shitaken acharecha. Because if you mess it up, there's no one's going to fix it. Right? I think that's certainly prudent advice for our topic as well. Right? Certainly genetically modified crops bring with them environmental concerns. In terms of the crops being able, through marketing even, or through just kind of like human adaptation, becoming a monoculture. Right? People planting only that one species of crop because it's advantageous, and competing out all the other natural species that exist, which makes that species more susceptible to disease. Right? It's kind of like when you plant trees in a city. Right? So you have to plant a diversity of trees, because what happens if there's like a disease one year that affects, you know, species of elm? So you don't want all your parks to be bare, right? So you have to diversify, nature works, that's how nature works, right? So there's that issue as well. So certainly environmental concerns have to be taken care of. And in source number 12, Rashi quotes the Medrash regarding Na'aseh Adam, let us make man, right? The question is always, why did God say it in the plural? Right? He's just provoking, right? And that's what Rashi says, that's what the Medrash says. Isn't he just provoking people there when he says, Na'aseh Adam, let us make man? Isn't that implying a multiplicity of divinity? And Rashi says, it was to teach us a lesson. And it was worth it. Even though, yes, it is provocative, it's to teach us a lesson. That God first, before he created something, he consulted with the ministering angels out of his own sense of humility. I think that's an important lesson for us. That, yes, we are creators, but it's important to approach nature with the realization of that sense of humility, with the realization that the ultimate lawgiver is God, the ultimate designer of nature is God, and God designed nature with much more and with infinite wisdom, and much more wisdom than we can ever approach in designing nature. Even the greatest scientists, right, can never fully comprehend the complexity of nature. And it's that sense of humility that I think is so important to bring into as we go forward in this endeavor of genetic engineering and genetic modification of foods. Because there's no turning back. Right? It's happened already. And it's just going to happen. But certainly for us to stress that sense of humility and caution and thinking about what are the possible impacts on the environment, what are the possible impacts on man, that's something we can never be too careful about. So I want to thank everyone for coming today.
Yeah.
If you have any questions, yeah.
I assume since we haven't heard differently that the general rabbinate says that it's okay to eat genetically modified food.
Yeah, I will point out that even if you would say that this is actually a problem of kilayim, let's say, which most people don't, but even if you say that it is a real iser of kilayim, kilayim are still permitted to be eaten. You can't be the farmer. But as an average consumer, even if it's real usur kilayim, the Mishnah in kilayim in Parachet says it's mutar be'achila and be'hana. It's permitted to eat it and permitted to derive benefit from it. Mm-hmm. It's not true regarding grapes. It's a little different. Regarding grapes, kilayah karam, it's prohibited in hana. So that would be an issue. But like I said, most people don't even assume that the true iser of kilayim, it doesn't apply in this case. So that's correct. There don't seem to be any kashrus issues. Yeah.
Modifying going on naturally.
Yeah.
When scientists dig up the old seeds or archaeologists may examine them.
Right.
Or what Darwin did in terms of evolution, which one time,
yeah,
I guess it's still controversial. Or when they discover, say, you know, with the Galapagos, mm-hmm, and the origins, and seeds can travel far and they adapt to the conditions.
Right.
So hasn't this been going on?
Right. It goes on naturally. The question is, should we speed it up? Right. It certainly goes on naturally. Right. Yeah.
Although it's not technically interbreeding.
Yeah.
What comes to my mind is Yaakov and how he mated
the sheep.
The speckled ones and the solid ones for just to increase his flock.
Yeah.
For his own.
Yeah.
Name.
It's fascinating. There's a professor, Carl Feit, who's a professor in the biology department at YU, wrote an article about this, about the genetics behind the story of Yaakov. So you could see there. But I don't remember his conclusion and his lessons.
A lesson from this that it's okay even if you're just financial.
Right, right. That is the story that people talk about generally in the context of genetics and genetic engineering. And
yeah,
that's a good point. All right, well, thank you everyone for coming.
Yeah.